You're listening to TFM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
Hey, everyone. I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Well, hello, and welcome to TFM's local Star Trek books and comic show, and I am just one of the hosts here, and about to be transient hosts, Matthew Rushing, but with me, as I'm so excited that they're going to be here from now into eternity. That's right. I've already got them locked into the contract, but none other than Casey and Jonathan. How are you guys doing?
Doing well.
I'm doing pretty good.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, as everybody knows, we're in a bit of a transition phase, the guys actually are going to have a comic catch-up episode coming up, so they're going to be covering all of the comics that we've been missing kind of transitioning the show a little bit. But we have a fantastic episode for you today, because even though we are not going to be covering any comics, we are going to be covering another new book, which I am super excited to have out. And that is, Casey, what are we covering today?
We are talking about Star Trek Picard, The Art and Making of the Series, which comes from Titan Books, and which is the same publisher that does the Star Trek Explorer magazine. So they've got a lot of great books out there. We talked about a couple of them. We talked about Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, The Making of the Classic Film, and Star Trek First Contact, The Making of the Classic Film, which I believe was by the same author as this one, John Fordham. So lots of exciting things here.
Yes. And of course, Star Trek II book was by the Tenutos, and we got to have them on the show. So go back in the catalog. You will absolutely want to listen to that. Of course, we want to thank Titan, as we do with our other books as well. We get review copies, and so thank you to these companies for sending them to us, because it really does make it much easier for us to be able to review things in a timely manner for everyone. And so really appreciate that. But okay, so before we dive into the book, this is something that I think would be kind of fun for us to be able to do. Overall, now that Star Trek Picard has finished, we all hope that we get Legacy. Give us Legacy, you cowards. But what was your overall feelings of, Star Trek Picard in general, now that we've got all three completed seasons?
You know, it's every season that came out, I feel like there was this new excitement, I guess, for it, and that kind of quietly faded throughout each season until we got to the third season, which I really enjoyed. But, you know, I remember first watching the first season of Picard, being so excited. And then as the season went on, got more and more confused, and it was just kind of weird. And then we get into season two and it's something completely different, which, you know, it was exciting to see Q. But, you know, season three, it's kind of like season three of The Next Generation. It's like where they really started finding their feet. And so, I mean, overall as a series, it's actually kind of hard for me to rank it or rate it, I should say, as a series, because we've got three very different seasons. But I'll watch season three over and over again. Definitely.
So for me, I read, I knew this show was coming out, and so I did watch the first season right as it aired. And as each episode progressed, I got less interested in it. I was most interested, obviously, because it's a new Star Trek season, and I was primarily most interested because Kirsten Beyer was on the writing staff and was credited as one of the show's creators. So when I started the show, I watched the first two episodes and I was like, this isn't really for me, but I will stay in it till Kirsten's episode. And I did stay in it till Kirsten's episode, and I didn't actually particularly like that episode. So I I'm like, what, 5 or 6 episodes in, may as well finish the season. So I did finish the season, but it just didn't work for me. And I'm going to be honest, I didn't even bother watching season 2. It just did not look particularly appealing to me. However, I heard from a few people online, particularly Robert Meyer Burnett, who said, season 3 is going to be amazing, guys. You need to watch this. And I was like, he felt the same as what I did with seasons 1 and 2. So I was like, I'll give season 3 a try. And I did. And from the first episode, the first day it came out, I was like, I have to watch these the day they come out now. I started scheduling my March, April, and May of, or February, March and April last year of making sure I had time on Thursdays to watch Picard, because I was hooked from the first episode, and I never lost that excitement the whole time. So I will say this now, I'll tip my hand. Season 3 of Picard is my favorite season of Star Trek ever. So it worked for me.
Man, I feel like you have not seen the last 2 seasons of Deep Space 9 then.
You would be correct.
Yeah. So, yeah, when you see those seasons and you finish that show, then get back to me. But I can understand if you haven't seen them, then this being way up there, 100%, because I mean, on that, I heartily agree. It's a fantastic season. And, you know, I'm more akin to you, Casey, in that Picard was coming out. That was great. You know, I got through, I think, maybe 2 episodes of Discovery before I put the kibosh on watching that, because I didn't feel like it was worth my time personally. It was not my thing. It was definitely not my bag. And so when they decided that they were going to do Star Trek Picard, that was something that obviously was very interesting to me, because growing up, you know, Picard was definitely a character I'm very familiar with. And when I started getting into Star Trek at that point, Star Trek The Next Generation was going on, but Deep Space Nine was the one I truly jumped into. And then I caught back up on, you know, the things that had happened in the Next Generation. And then, of course, I saw the movies as they were coming out, and grew to love that crew and those characters. And so was very interested to see, okay, we're bringing Picard back. This could be really interesting. And it also meant we were really playing in, I think, a part of the universe that I had really cared about, of course. We're going past Deep Space Nine and Voyager and the Next Generation now. And so I couldn't wait to see what they were going to do. And then the first season happened, and I found myself to be like you, Casey, where it felt like I kept getting more confused as each episode went out, because it just didn't seem to be clicking. And there were so many things that just didn't seem to feel congruous with what we had seen previously in the 24th, 25th century. And then season 2 came out, and I found that to be a better season. Still has issues, but it was better, and mainly because I think that season, regardless of the overall of it, the biggest thread was the character of Picard, and trying to dig into him, which it felt like, okay, if we're going to do this show, it's called Picard, let's actually talk about Picard. And they did in season 2, and they actually put him in a much more healthy place by the end of it. So, you know, it ameliorated some of the issues I had with the season. And then season 3 comes out, and anybody can go and listen to the Artificial Tango. And Chris and I had a blast talking about the season, and I think it's an incredible season of Star Trek. And, you know, I've said it there, and I'll say it here. I think the reason that it was is because it made no bones about loving Star Trek and honoring Star Trek that came before, while at the same time trying to forge a new legacy, a new future. And I think that's the thing that we kind of hoped, I think many of us fans, was what they were going to do. And so I wanted to start there, because I think, you know, the book here, is it starts about kicking off this new story here for the for Picard and the reasons for bringing this character back, right? And so I'm really interested to have this discussion with you both about what we learn in the book as to why they decided to bring the character back and why Patrick Stewart decided to come back when he swore he would never do this again.
I thought it was interesting that, you know, when they were trying to come up with a new new series after they launched Star Trek Discovery, you know, you've got Alex Kurtzman and his company kind of and they've got like a writer's room and they're kind of trying to figure out what's the next thing that they're going to do. And I think somewhere in the book it even said that Alex Kurtzman has never heard the word no before or something like that. And so, you know, they thought, well, even though Patrick Stewart has always said no, let's make him an offer he can't refuse, essentially, and, you know, bring him, see what we can do to bring him back. And, you know, I think going into the future, like you were talking about, Matthew, with past Voyager, past Deep Space Nine and Voyager and everything, and really the kicker being, you know, the question to Patrick Stewart, well, have you changed in the last 25 years? Well, yeah, so has Picard. And I think it's not necessarily something I think that we all needed to see, like what happened to Picard, you know, 20, 25 years in the future. But it was an interesting concept to see like a changed Picard, you know, regardless of how you feel with where they took the character or where they took the Federation or anything like that. It is kind of interesting, when you start thinking about these characters that we love, like where are they that far in the future? And, you know, especially as you talk about like legacy, you know, and these legacy characters, I think there's a lot of characters we'd like to see. If we could get Avery Brooks back in the, you know, in the acting game, I think that nobody would turn down watching that show.
For me, as I read the opening, which I was most fascinated by the book when it talked about the writing and conceptual ideas of how they made the show, that was what I really latched on to, because I'm more interested in writing anyway than the art stuff. But when this was unfolding, I thought a couple of things. One was I have recently changed my belief on how actors how important their voice in the conversation should be, primarily because of the Patrick Stewart's involvement in Picard. Because at least from my perspective, I think he had the wrong instincts for what would make the series great. I think that, you know, the idea of the character changing to a point works, but when you have such a dedicated fan base and such an old fan base that's been there with him, when you change the character, they feel a little slighted, which I think has happened in other franchises as well. But also the idea of just not including many other members in the first two of the next gen cast, of making it so disconnected from Starfleet, from making it so disconnected from those touchstones of Star Trek, I think really were not the right instincts for the series, which is why I think season 3 works so well, is because it goes in the complete opposite direction from those instincts. And one of the reasons, you know, a lot of people talk about how much we appreciate Terry Metalis, and I think that with that you see is as soon as they brought on Terry, you see the shift happening. Even in season 2, where he was a little bit involved, you can see the shift towards adding those familiar elements to the series.
Yeah, a couple of things. One is that season 1, I didn't realize this, but because there was no merger at this point, they were actually hampered by doing some of the Star Trek stuff. And using some of the Star Trek stuff as well. And so that didn't help the season, the first season especially. But I think, you know, Jonathan, you rightly put your finger on something that I have long thought, and that is, and especially with Star Trek, and this happened specifically in Nemesis, where Brent Spiner and Patrick Stewart both began and had, and this happened also in Insurrection, too much of a say in what was going to happen with their characters, and therefore it became the Picard and Data show, and they made decisions there that I don't necessarily think always fit the storyline. Of course, Nemesis is also hampered more by the fact that, you know, the director does not care about Star Trek and cut all the Star Trek stuff out of the story, and especially when it came to the family stuff, which we know was in the script by John Logan and just didn't get utilized. And so the biggest problem, though, really, again, the idea of Picard changing as a person after 25 years, of course, that is an incredible idea for a story, because all characters change and should change in that time period. And the interesting thing is that Picard himself really hasn't changed all that much. What happens is that the universe around him has changed. You know, I think in some ways it's akin to Man of Steel. Superman hadn't changed, but the universe around him had. And so the acceptance of him and his ideals are completely different. And yet, I think the biggest problem comes in is that, you know, it says specifically in the book that he had been reading this book on fascism. And my issue comes with this. When you begin a story with the goal to write about something specific, instead of allowing what you believe to just come out in your writing, you actually hurt your writing, because everything becomes so much more surface level instead of integrated into everything else. And I think that's one of the things that really hurt the series, and this first season specifically, and the second season in some ways. But with the first season as well, this season, and I want to ask you, Casey, because I know, Jonathan, you haven't seen very much of Deep Space Nine, but Casey, everything that they're almost trying to do with the Federation feels like somebody never watched Deep Space Nine and what the Federation had gone through and all of the questions that that show asked of the Federation and pushing its limits as to, okay, we say we're this utopia, but we're going to push that to the limits. What happens when our backs are against the wall? Will we be that utopia or will we not? And Deep Space Nine, I feel like, had already answered all of those questions in a much more robust and I think much more interesting way. And then this season comes along and it almost feels like the Federation hadn't been through those experiences and had learned nothing from those experiences. And therefore, that's where we get the kind of crux of the storyline with, you know, the reaction to the Synth Rebellion and, you know, giving up, helping the Romulans and basically just abandoning Federation ideals whole hog and becoming, you know, isolationists.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that Deep Space Nine did really well was to show what the Federation, what Starfleet looked like, kind of when they're at their limits of, you know, an enemy, like enemies. I mean, we've seen it in Next Gen and, you know, Star Trek First Contact, you know, with the Borg as well. But, you know, when the Dominion comes in, I mean, you know, we got to see through those last couple seasons of Deep Space Nine, the Starfleet kept having to, you know, fall back. Like, they lost the station. They, you know, spoiler alert. Sorry, Jonathan. But they, you know, they, but they, and there was times where Sisko or, you know, our other, you know, Deep Space Nine heroes kind of had to be the, kind of be the light they, you know, that they wanted Starfleet to be. You know, so that when the war was over, Starfleet was still the, or, and the Federation was still the same organization that we'd had before. Maybe, you know, they took their licks in the war and they've got to kind of recover from that and everything. But yeah, by the time we get to Picard, it's like they've decided, well, because we've been through what we've been through in the past, we really need to kind of watch our own backs. And, you know, they tried to do this humanitarian thing for the Romulans. For some reason, the Synth Rebellion kind of made them just say, you know what, we're not actually going to help the Romulans anymore. I know that they thought maybe the Romulans had something to do with that, but you don't usually see Starfleet, like, backing down so easily, you know, in that, the face of adversity like that. And, you know, I know they lost a lot of ships and everything from that, or the ability to build the ships, you know, on Mars. But yeah, I feel like they just kind of looked too much inwards, I guess, and less outwards to their friends on other planets, their allies, their, even their enemies. I mean, the fact that they just gave up, and it's something, you know, we talked about a little bit with David Mack, in his book, Firewall, on kind of how the circumstances that led to the Fenris Rangers kind of becoming what they were, you know, when Starfleet just pulled out of a whole area and just ignored everybody. And it's just like, this Federation doesn't see, it seems like it's shrinking. I'd almost want to see a map that sees, that shows, you know, at its height and then what it's at now in Star Trek Picard, because it just seems like they're retreating into themselves and not trying to get back out and explore, I guess.
Well, and I like that you are saying that, because as we watch Deep Space Nine, I think very much the lesson of Deep Space Nine for the Federation becomes that it is better with its allies and creating new friends than it is alone. And that seems to be, again, another place where this show completely discounts that. And that lesson, which I don't quite understand. And so, you know, all to say, you know, this is a really interesting book in the sense that it does give us the opportunity to have a nice background for each of the seasons, as well as, of course, the story that happens. And so as they give us kind of as in-depth of a look of each season as we'll get, what did you guys think about what we learn about the first season, the design choices they make, the story choices they make? Was there anything that stood out to you that you really interested in, or that you thought, huh, that seems like a dubious choice?
Well, one of the things I thought was interesting was they talk about how they really wanted, the Starfleet headquarters to look like a blend of kind of like old and new, where they had an existing building, an existing plaza that they had, and then they added in some elements to it. And we have this big page of artwork in here, and it just, maybe it's the way the artwork was done, but it just felt so un-Star Trek-y. It just felt so just like it was just like a painting of the actual place rather than concept art. I just thought that was interesting. And a lot of the production feels, the word I would use is on season one, is natural. A lot of the shots are exterior shots. It looks like they shot on location for a lot of it. It looks like there isn't as much, except for a few times, it doesn't look as sci-fi. It looks much more grounded than other Star Trek shows.
Yeah, grounded is a good word. Like, I mean, it really does feel like that's what they were going for. I mean, it's almost like the first season of Enterprise that they wanted to, you know, kind of keep out of space. They want to keep it on Earth, and it seems like they were kind of going for that. They wanted to have some kind of Star Trek adventure, but really kind of keeping it more grounded, you know, like literally on Earth in the first season. And, you know, even, you know, barring some of the hurdles they had of, you know, licensing issues, especially early on in the season, they did have, there were some neat little callbacks, I guess, you know, seeing Picard at his, you know, vineyards in France, you know, which we, you know, it's obviously a different location, but, you know, we got to see it during the show. And so we kind of knew what it was like. And then just some of the elements that they were able to bring back, you know, we got the Borg, we've got Data, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I mean, which were some interesting choices, but, you know, as far as like how they designed the show, it definitely felt, I keep coming back to that word, grounded take on kind of our Star Trek Earth.
And to me, at least in a few ways, as you read this, and really this is more for all three seasons, you can very clearly see the budgetary constraints in the way they talk about things, like the way that La Serena is redressed for season three, the way that it's kind of obvious now after reading this that the reason that Picard uses his office as the holodeck was not so much that he really actually loved that office, but more because they had already built the set for it for episode one, and they're like, we can use this again later on in the season, and it's cheaper than building a new set. And so I thought Star Trek was a little bit beyond these budgetary things when they promised that they were increasing the budgets and trying to make things look movie quality, and yet the TV budget stuff still plagues them.
Yeah, I think some of the interesting things for me on this season, and I hear what you're saying, Jonathan, especially one of the shows that has done this the best was Andor, mm-hmm. in the sense that it uses a lot of real locations and then turns them into Star Wars locations, yes. by augmenting them so much so that you can't tell what's real and what wasn't. Mm-hmm. And that show's incredible in that way. And I think that's what they kind of wanted for, especially season one, when we were at Starfleet headquarters and those kind of things. They wanted to show the passage of time, that technology had changed in 25 years, which makes sense, I think, you know. And yet, I think the issue became, you know, of course, Kurtzman is the one who's partially responsible for the Kelvin timeline. And of course, they brought that aesthetic into Discovery, which was a massive failure and a stupid decision because it did not fit in that time period. And it works better here, though, because it works as a extrapolation of the technology that we had gotten in the Next Generation and then amplifying that by 25 years worth of technology design. And so I don't have as much a problem with that stuff. I do think one of the biggest issues becomes that the La Serena itself just feels too generic. It doesn't feel special. You know, Star Trek, we're used to our ships feeling special, and it doesn't feel special. And then, of course, one of the worst decisions that they make is at the very end when they are, I guess, so constrained by budget that every ship that shows up in Riker's fleets is literally the same, and they're the ugliest ship I've ever seen.
Yes, that bugged me when I watched it the first time.
Yes, so there's that. I think the biggest thing is, and I, with season one specifically, and what we learned there, we don't really go into a lot of detail as to the story itself and the story choices that they make, in the sense of, okay, why are we choosing to tell this story about the Romulans and then the Borg? And then, like, it doesn't really seem like we're telling, it's Star Trek Picard, right? But what does this have to do with Picard? Why is he involved? You know, I think that's the thing with season one, is that it felt like a generic sci-fi show with some Star Trek trappings and Picard's name slapped on it. It didn't feel like it really had anything to do with him. And I think in some ways the coverage of that season kind of reflects that then. And so, Jonathan, I'm really interested because, you know, you said you had not seen season two. So looking at season two and, you know, what they give us on that season, what did you think?
Well, it was interesting that because I actually didn't know about the time travel stuff. So when I read that, I thought that's interesting because some of my favorite Star Trek media has that time travel element. I mean, my favorite movie is The Voyage Home. And I enjoy First Contact a lot. So I was like, okay, that seems interesting. The way that they deal with the Borg here is just a interesting decision. Because especially when you put it in context. And the Borg really, even more so than the character of Picard, the Borg are one of the interesting through lines of, that you see in each season. Whereas the Borg feel like window dressing and Easter egg purposes a lot in the first season. And it was like, okay, we need this ship. We'll make it an ex-Borg cube and we'll tie that in somehow. And so it seemed a lot more focused on that. And then season two, they wanted to make it a central element. But again, we talked before about changing the way you view something. It doesn't feel necessarily like an evolution of the way we've viewed the Borg in The Next Generation and then the Next Gen movies and Voyager. It feels more like just taking a totally different spin. So if this was an alternate universe, or when I say alternate universe, I mean like kind of like the Kelvin timeline type thing, I'd be like, I like this, but even because it's the still using these versions of the characters, it just feels off. And when we talk about season three, I could talk about why I feel like the Borg is used properly there.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, the Borg were a very strange element of season two. And I mean, even, you know, with where they took Jurati's character, it was almost like it was a separate storyline kind of going on. And actually, in a lot of ways, it really was a separate storyline, just kind of a B story, you know, throughout the season. And, you know, one of the things that I liked about the second season was just the focus on Picard himself and his past. It was a stretch for me with the time travel going back and meeting one of his ancestors. It didn't, I remember so little from that season and even those the one conversation that he had with his ancestor, Rene. You know, but I did like seeing some of the things from him as a child with his mother and her, you know, mental illness, his visions of his father, that they barely talk about in the book, interestingly enough. In fact, even this whole storyline with his mom and his own self-reflection is maybe like a 2-page spread is really all it gets in this book, which was kind of interesting. And I mean, part of that's just 'cause it's an art book and even the part that it was talking about was the stained glass, but you know, like this season, I enjoyed it because of John DeLancey and the few times he shows up, and it's, you know, interesting seeing our characters out of place and everything. But I do wish at this point, you know, they added some Easter eggs with the Sanctuary Districts, which takes us back to Deep Space Nine again. This is right around the same time as the episode Past Tense from Deep Space Nine, but, yeah, like, you know, the book kind of just highlighted for me, like, this one, you know, the chapter on season two, or kind of the section on season two in the book, really kind of highlighted almost what the problems were with this season, and just that it was just this kind of jumbled mess of ideas that they kind of threw in and called it a season. And, you know, it was fun. It had some fun things and some, you know, more Star Trek callbacks probably than even season one did. But, you know, I think we mentioned earlier, this might have been part of Terry Metalis's touch on this particular season. But, you know, it just, I don't know. Yeah, there was just so many things that, like, as I was reading this section of this book, I was like, wow, I do not remember season two except for, like, Q, them going back in time and like an alternate reality. That's about it.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because I've heard a lot of people kind of, they've complained about the way in which this kind of dealt with the time period we go back to, but then to be reminded, this is literally the same time period as what we saw in Past Tense. Was really interesting. I think it's interesting, though, that it doesn't quite line up. It doesn't feel like the same time period, but okay, I can go with that. And, you know, it reminds us, too, that, you know, what happened with Khan in 1996, this is the world that looks like then, you know, and so then, of course, when you get to them changing the timeline.
I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, in Strange New Worlds, where Khan is then, it just doesn't make any sense. Anyway, so I think the thing about this, and learning in this season and seeing what they're trying to do in the season is interesting. But I think the thing that really comes to mind here is the problem that is you had pointed out, Jonathan, on our outline, is the missed opportunity to, if you're creating these two seasons simultaneously, don't step on each other's toes. The problem here is that you're stepping on each other's toes with the way that you're dealing with the Borg, and it just doesn't make sense then. It doesn't make sense that the Jurati Borg wouldn't be involved then after what happens at the end of season two. And this is the thing. The interesting thing about season two was it was an interesting way to deal with the Borg for once and for all. It felt like a once and for all, like, hey, we're done now with the Borg. We don't need to touch them anymore because we found a way. We've gone back in time. We've kind of retroactively found this way to ameliorate all the issues, because, but then season three and season two just don't play well together in that sense. And I think for the most part, that's kind of what hurts the season the most, is that season three just then seems to take almost zero of what it did and move forward. And I mean, you don't even deal with the whole thing about the fact that Picard has dealt with all of his issues in season two, so that by that point he can profess his love for Laris, and by season three we disregard her so that we can go with his relationship with Crusher and with having a son, which is always the place that they should have gone anyway. And the only reason they didn't has to do with Patrick Stewart. And that brings us back to that. And so really, I think the biggest problem with this is that each of these seasons is so disconnected from one another. And that's a real disservice, not only to fans, but the way that we supposedly make television these days. I mean, at least, Strange New Worlds is consistent in its storytelling each season, and it's not just messing things up for no good reason.
Yeah, one of the things that I was hoping for from this book was something to help us connect these seasons. And I mean, it was an uphill battle for this author, so I don't, fault him at all for that. But it is kind of, just a missed opportunity to just connect the dots and, because I mean, even as you read the book, each of the sections representing one season, within the book, you could pick that up anywhere. Like nothing that came before it matters, and like you said, Matthew, like season three does feel like it totally disregards pretty much everything. I think there's one mention in season three of the show that he's in a synthetic body, when they're looking for his real body, and But, and the stuff with the Borg and everything, like, the Borg would like, that's like kind of low hanging fruit to kind of connect the seasons at least. But, even more, it highlights kind of some of the problems that Discovery even had, where, Discovery season one had, I think it was season one, had two sets of showrunners. It started with Brian Fuller and then it moved to, those other couple of people whose name escaped me right now. But, and then season two, like those showrunners were around for a little while and then they switched again. And then, so Picard was like that with Michael Chabon being brought in to be the showrunner, which seemed a little strange because he wasn't involved in the conception of the show and everything, but they brought him in. And then they moved it to, I think, Akiva Goldsman for the second season. When they brought on Terry Metalis, that's when they were like, we're going to film both of these back to back. So Terry Metalis had to really kind of take a back seat in season two and move to season three. But so now once again, they've created this series that has no consistency because they don't have consistent visions, showrunners. I mean, the writers were probably mostly the same, but like, you got different people's visions. It's kind of like the Star Wars sequel trilogy, people come in and they have different ideas and they want to execute those.
When it came to talking to people I knew when season three came out, I, of course, started from the first episode and was hooked. And one of my friends was the same as me. He had watched season one, didn't particularly love it, didn't even bother with season two. And he was so apprehensive because he just felt so burned by this. And I kept telling him, you need to watch, you need to watch. And when episode nine of season three came out, he decided to watch. He said, what do I need to know? I said, you'll figure it out. And he did. And then my dad, I convinced him, he was like, I'll watch it if you watch it with me. And before the first episode, I gave him like a 5-minute primer on what had happened in season one. And he picked up everything else. The whole synth body stuff, I didn't even mention that in my primer on stuff. And he kind of figured that out on his own. So it never to him felt like he was missing something a lot. And my mom's came in for the first two episodes of the season and the last two episodes of the season, and she felt like she was able to put stuff together. And so it shows that really they were so disconnected like that, that you could just watch a single season and not feel you're missing a whole lot before.
That's what we talk about with the tie-in fiction too, you know, when the authors in the 24th century, you know, post Nemesis books, you know, they always talk about like, you know, it's always nice if you can read the books ahead of it, but, you know, anything that the author needs you to know for the current book you're reading is dropped in there somehow. And I feel like that's what Terry Metalis did for season three. He dropped those nuggets in to say, like, you know what, if you pick this up right now, you're going to be just fine. And which is, you know, why we need to give him more Star Trek to make.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most interesting thing about the season three, right, becomes the fact that by this point they are able to they're able to talk Patrick Stewart into kind of doing what they should have done at the beginning, which is this is the thing. If you had had cohesive seasons, you could have slowly been working to the point where you get to season three organically with all of the characters we love. So you could have had, in some ways, the thing that he didn't want right away, but you would have had the ability then to have a cohesive whole with all three seasons. And you know, and that's the other part of this too, is that what it becomes frustrating is that season three is so great, but even that feels a little bit rushed at times, where you wish that they would have been setting up some of these storylines from the beginning so that you could have more organically been dropping in all of these characters and building those relationships a little bit. And, you know, maybe even building in the fact that, yeah, we haven't heard from Beverly in so long and all this stuff. And so that by the time you get to season three, you're ready to just hit the ground running, and you can even do more than they're able to do here, because you have to do that so quickly in every single episode, and you don't get necessarily the time. And I think that's, you know, when we talk about missed opportunities, I think the interconnectedness of these seasons is the place where that really gets hurt, because everybody agrees. I don't think there's anybody out there really that doesn't agree that Star Trek Picard season three was the pinnacle of this show and the best thing that they've done in Star Trek since the end of, you know, Enterprise, in the sense of what's on television. So,
for getting into that discussion of of rushing it versus not rushing it, with the fact that they only had 10 episodes, I feel like they did an excellent, like, if we're saying the constraints are you have 10 episodes to do this story, I think they did it masterfully, because A, they don't bring in the entire TNG cast in the first episode. They really bring in three. You bring in Picard and Beverly and Riker. And then you slowly, as the season progresses, bring in the other characters. And then not only do you bring in the other characters, you also slowly bring in the storyline and the mystery behind it, and you pay off a lot of things. And they could have been easily tempted to start off with them on the Enterprise D, But they didn't do that. They wisely saved that for the final episode plus the stinger on episode 9. And so because of that, you feel it's a little bit earned because they spent time getting there. And there's a reason why they has to be on the D instead of other ships that they could take in the fleet. And so because of that, I feel like, you know, if I'm understanding, we're not going to get 30 episodes like it should have been. It's just going to be 10. With the with what they had to work with, they, I don't know how they could have made that part work out better.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, they definitely used their time wisely in that third season, and I can't remember, the book talks about some story ideas that they had to drop. I think, I can't remember if it was for season 3 or season 2, but, you know, because of the constraints in number of episodes. And I do think that as much as we would always want to see more, you know, things can get kind of lost, you know, and as we've seen in Discovery, they got like, they started with 10, then went to 13, then I think 15 episodes for the first season or something like that as they were making it. And maybe they should have stuck with 10, you know, like, and it does, I think, force creatives to really keep what's important in the story and not add too much fluff. I mean, there was definitely a lot more, you know, dialogue, you know, exposition kind of stuff in season 3, but that's what we got in The Next Generation. We liked seeing people talking. We liked seeing them sitting around a conference table. And I think that just further added to the story rather than just having, you know, phasers blasting and, you know, like fights and whatever. Like, you know, we want to see some of the slow stuff too. And that just worked in season 3 and, you know, getting them around the conference table, getting them, I mean, even just in the same room together, let alone the bridge of the Enterprise D. But yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. Like they definitely use their time wisely.
And when we were talking about touchstones of the series, that one thing I love that season 3 does is in the first episode, when they go and see the Titan for the first time, you get a tiny bit of the classic themes, and then you get the Leaving Starbase music, which is original. But when I listened to it the first time, I was like, man, this sounds like a Horner score right here. And then there are times in the Nebula in the third episode where I was like, this music feels like it is Horner's score from Wrath of Khan. But it wasn't. It was the composer understood how to make an original piece that felt like something else. You've got the vibes of the movies, but it was still an original composition, and he's not just quoting other stuff. So I really liked, and you see that throughout the whole season, and they talk about this here, how they'll maybe quote like a measure or two, but most of it is original music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's one of the smartest things that they did for the season, you know, and I was very much glad that they did such a great job with the music. And so was there anything here with the book that you weren't a fan of, or you wish that had more done to it, or?
No, I mean, I think I really enjoyed the artwork that we got to see, you know, like the photos, kind of some of the more, you know, high res things behind the scenes. I always love the behind the scenes. So, you know, I really enjoyed that. The only thing that I'd say is just kind of they could have taken some creative license on trying to connect the seasons more, but, you know, the author's also working with what he had. So like I said before, I can't really fault him for that.
For me, I really wish this book had been split into two, because the title of it is The Art and Making of the Series. And if this book, the craft elements of this book are just not what draw me. And so the craft elements of the costumes and the makeup and the set design stuff was just not as appealing. And that was a significant portion of the book. And anytime they got to the writing, I was super invested. And had the book been exclusively focused on the writing choices, they could have focused more, given us more answers on the connectivity or lack of it. They could have talked more about the decisions they made episode by episode, because this felt more thematically like oh, we're going to talk about Seven of Nine's costume now. Oh, and we're going to talk about this, rather than a straight going through of episode by episode why each episode was written the way it was or something. And that I would have found immensely entertaining. And I still think as a book, it's very interesting. But with this type of a book, that's a huge price tag that you have for people. And you have to justify the price tag. And so I feel like there's a very specific type of person that would have to be interested in this book. You have to, a lot of things have to converge for you. And I don't know if that's enough to make it as commercially successful as it could have been.
I don't really have necessarily an issue with it being the art and making of. I think that what's kind of interesting is that there's just not enough art. And then there's, like you said, there's not enough making of. And I think the problem is that you're trying to cram too much into one book. You know, you're basically giving 150 pages or some odd pages to three seasons of television, and Star Trek Picard season 3 on its own.
Could have been this whole book.
Mm-hmm. Could have been this whole book, exactly. And I think that's really the biggest issue here. And in all honesty, I think the problem is that season 3 deserved its own book. And partially because that's the one we all cared about. And so, yeah, all in all, I guess I come down to the big question here then. What would you rate the art and making of Star Trek Picard?
So I gave this one a 4 on Goodreads. It's probably more of a 3.5. You know, it's I keep saying, I don't want to fault the author for, you know, what was, you know, for what I consider missed opportunities. But I mean, yeah, I hear what you guys are saying. You know, like, it's kind of not enough of a lot of different things. And if I remember correctly, I think when this book was first announced, it was just going to be seasons 1 and 2. But when they announced season 3 of Picard, and I think everyone saw where the direction was going, I feel like it got delayed. I think we talked about this last time. Maybe it didn't get delayed, but, you know, like it does kind of feel like, you know, it would have been better suited to as a, season 3 only, but then I don't know, you lose out on, I guess, all the creatives, you know, that were involved in the first two seasons, regardless of what you think. But again, I 3.5, 4 on Goodreads is kind of where I landed on that.
I feel woefully unprepared for my rating. I haven't given it, like, in my written review and in my YouTube video that I made, I haven't given it a rating, because this is not, I've never reviewed art books before. I have one art book that I reviewed because it was my favorite artist ever, and it was purely his paintings in there, and it talked about them. But other than that, like, I don't own art books. This is the first time I'm getting into it. So I don't have a great grasp on, this is what other art books would do better, this is how other art books would do worse. I can only give the grasp of what I wanted to see. I feel safe giving it like a 3.5 or a 4 out of 5. But that's with the caveat of, I really don't have a barometer to compare it to of previous art books.
I think that I would end up giving this 3.5 out of 5. I think that it's good. I think that we've talked about some of the things that could have made it better, and a lot of those things, I don't necessarily know if they have anything to do with the author. I think it's more the constraints of the book and the length of the book, you know, and if you had more page count to be able to really dive into each season the way it deserves, I think this would have been better. You know, I think of the fact that the first two seasons of The Mandalorian each got their own art and making of book, and, you know, that was nice, and they haven't done one for season 3 or anything else, and I think part of that was COVID and all that stuff. But, you know, yeah, this, I think it's good, but like Star Trek Picard, it's good, not great. It except for the last season. And even too, I mean, you think that last season, there's just so much that we miss out on about really getting to talk about the design of the Titan. And all of those things that go along with that, the choices they made and why they made them in that. And, you know, we got a little bit of that in the sense that budgetarily we're constrained to use the bridge of the Stargazer and just redress it because there's like a few days between filming season two and season three. But, you know, it is what it is, and I think it's a good book, and it's definitely enjoyable for anybody who likes getting more behind the scenes. It does seem like we just missed an opportunity to have a more robust look at every single season's behind the scenes.
Matthew, I think you mentioned at the top of the show, we're going to be doing a comics catch-up episode next time. And, you know, so if we, you know, didn't get enough art in this book, you know, Jonathan, you've got some comics to catch up on, and we can review some more art there.
I have read them.
Okay. You got some opinions in the
mostly
got some
questions.
Opinions loaded. Okay. Well, we'll see if we can answer some.
This will be fun for everyone, but hopefully everybody enjoyed the episode I was talking about the art and making of Star Trek Picard. And if you wanted to catch up with you, Jonathan, if people wanted to catch up with you, Jonathan, where would they find you?
You can find me primarily on YouTube for my book reviews for Star Trek, Star Wars, and all sorts of genres. I cover even like legal thriller, everything. That's just my name, Jonathan Cohn. You can find me on Twitter at Jonathan Cohn, and Goodreads. My Goodreads account is Jonathan Cohn, so I'm very consistent.
Yeah, and you can find me on Goodreads, Letterboxd, Instagram, Twitter at Knitting Trekkie, and you can also find me lurking around in the Babel Conference on Facebook.
And, of course, you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02 here on the network. You can find me outside of Star Trek Talk on the 602 Club, talking about all of those fandoms we love. But then, of course, inside Star Trek, you can find me doing the Orb, Warp 5, Artificial Tango, and Saddle Up. And then over on the Nerd Party Network, you can find the completed show Owl Post with Dre Kaufman, talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, and Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and until next time, live long
and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.